Welcome to Backyards and Bevies. Grab your favorite bevy, pull up a chair, and enjoy the ride.
Hey, B&B fam. This podcast is sponsored to you by BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. Is there something getting in the way of your happiness? I know when I traveled the world, I had many days where BetterHelp's worldwide service of licensed professional therapists could have helped me speak to someone no matter where I was in the world about whatever was happening with my life and with zero judgment. With their ability to match me with a therapist that best fits me, I know my mental health would have been way better back then. Believe me, I needed it. But I'm here to share a way for you to take back control of your mental health by telling you about BetterHelp's awesome services they have for you to talk with a pro about your life through their app or just online. Whether it is a video session or some simple messaging, their team is here to help. I went to check out the app for myself just to see how easy it was to use, and after a series of questions, I was told I would be able to start matching with a therapist in under 48 hours. And what is super rad is that it's affordable and they even offer financial aid too. So come join the 2 million users that have already been helped and gain back control of your mental health by visiting betterhelp.com/backyards for 10% off your first month. Remember, BetterHelp is therapy done securely online. Don't forget to use the special code BACKYARDS and let BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, help you to start living a happier life today. Hey, welcome to Studios and Bevies this week. We are in a recording studio with my buddy, Tori.
What's up, buddy?
Hey, I am actually warm, which is awesome. So thanks for having us inside today at this lovely place that you help run.
Yeah, welcome to Starstruck here in the pond.
Yeah.
Our B studio. And,
why do they call it the pond?
Well, truly, there is a pond out front here with the horses.
Yeah,
That's a lot of people, when they drive by this building, are like, oh, that's the one with the horses jumping out of the pond. And it's like, yeah, but this is... That's truly the name of this B studio because of that. But we've got the gallery over there, which is our A studio, and then the pond over here, and this is one of my favorite control room. Like this space is one of my favorite spaces.
Yeah, I actually sat in here not too long ago and listened to a song getting re-recorded. I mean, it was amazing. It was fun.
This vocal booth specifically, the other room is kind of like the big old tracking space. This room is all the isolation. So we've got slate room, big vocal booth, and then a piano room over there. But that room specifically is the Jesus Take the Wheel, all the Carrie Underwood.
Oh, wow.
A lot of the Luke Bryan stuff, Taylor Swift.
Oh, my gosh.
That was kind of like in that room. So it's a pretty iconic room to be, you know.
Yeah. This building, I mean, on Music Row is one of... a stop. I know that they stop those like tour buses and stuff like that, and they stop and they talk about this place. And I mean, it's an amazing building. I've been swinging through here now for about 4 years, and every time I'm in here, I learn something new about it, or I see a different room, and I'm like, whoa, this is just incredible. And the console behind us is what?
It's an SSL 9000J, and when Reba built this building, she went out and scored two of these back in the day, and they only actually, we just had SSL in here. I was just telling you about that. And I asked him, I said, how many of these specifically of the J's were built? And it was only like 200 were built. And like Dr. Dre, that's like, that's what he
had,
you know? And so we got two of them, and our tech, Sean, he's great. He has gone through and recapped, reswitched, recalibrated this whole console to the point where we're one of the only studios in the world that still has one of these up and going.
Oh, my God.
And we've got a few old school mixers that will still sit in front of this console and mix and use every, you know, channel on it. So we have to keep it up and going for those guys. And, it's pretty remarkable when you think about it. And I asked him, I said, how many are currently running, do you think, nowadays? And he was like, I don't know, maybe like 15, 20.
I was about to say 10.
You know,
like that,
so it's pretty cool. At this point, it's like we just got to keep them going, you know.
Do you give a lot of tours in these rooms?
We do. Yeah. I mean, we getting people in the room to just see it. And there's we've been here long enough where there's generations. Mm-hmm. So it's like... oh, I worked in there 20 years or 30 years ago situation, but I haven't been back. So like,
can I see what it looks like now?
And, you know, there's still a lot that hasn't changed, you know, but there is a lot that has changed and that we're doing, and we're building a Dolby Atmos room right now, and we're always getting new gear and making improvements. So just getting people in, and that's how you keep things rolling and people see it again. And then the next time they've got a project or session, it's like, oh, let's go to Starstruck.
Yeah. So Carrie's guy, is his name Mark?
Say that again.
The engineer that comes, is it Mark?
Mark Bright.
Mark Bright.
He did all that stuff back in the day. And then Derek Basin, Derek has been here. He's probably worked on this console in this room more than anybody else. And
really?
He's done all the Rascal Flat stuff, did the Carrie stuff with Mark back in the day, and then currently does all the Luke Bryan stuff, and he's old school.
Wow.
He'll sit here and, like I said, mix on every channel this thing. And
I've never sat in a studio with him. I only met him on the road and stuff, but I mean, it's a completely different ear. It's a completely different feeling. It's a completely different everything when you're in a studio, because you're fine tuning, you're looking for certain tones, and I mean,
yeah, and knowing a room the room and the gear that you're working with, and you know,
makes you feel comfy.
It does. And that's why, you know, Derek or certain guys that have worked here a long time, they know this gear, they know the room.
Yeah.
You know, in the live room, it's like, oh, if we set the drums up in this corner versus this corner, and having somebody who knows that.
I mean,
how do you put a price on something like that? You know?
Well, and you make the artist feel comfortable too.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you're not bumbling around like, oh, let me go look for this or that.
You just know
where you are.
I'm looking for this sound. I'm looking for X, Y, Z. And it's like, oh, yeah, boom. We'll
Bam.
Do this. Yeah.
I want to come back to that Dolby thing here in a second, but I actually got to go. A good friend of mine took me on a day off to Studio, I want to say A in Capitol Records, and I got to sit behind two awesome engineers, Al and I'm spacing on the other guy's name right now just because it's early morning, but it was just amazing to watch them know a room, because when Al walked in, he like grabbed two faders, brought it up on a piano, and it sounded
like a million bucks,
gold in my ears. Like I was like, wow. Or did you just drop diamonds like everywhere in the room? Because it was something magical. It was, but
truly.
And what was even cooler is, you know, he hit the reverb, and to know that that reverb wasn't something that was done like in a box. Actually, it was sent down into a basement.
Yep.
Who knows how many feet away through cables, hit a speaker, actually was in a reverb chamber, and then came back and hit the console again. And then as he brought it up, it was a different sound. And I think that's what makes albums, you know, it's like, you can create an album anywhere nowadays because of all the digital stuff.
And they've recreated those specific reverbs, but there's something to be said about, you know, I think when the digital movement came around 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the home studio movement, everybody got home studio, you know, and the idea of spending money to come into a room was like, oh, we don't need to do that anymore. Now I think the pendulum has swung where there's kind of this happy medium balance where it's like, okay, if we're going to go do this project, let's go and get in a legit room with a real console and go and track this thing and go and then lay down some killer vocals on it. And then if we want to fine tune it, lay the diamonds on it, you know, whatever, we'll take it home and finish it up at that point.
Exactly.
And put all the secret sauce on it. But so it's kind of like this happy medium of like,
well, and then there's the mastering side too. So it's like, you know, getting good solid tracks though, that's the important, like that's like, if you can start the foundation,
that's right.
And I've seen engineers, you know, over the years struggle live with like, let's say just like something as simple as a guitar or a snare.
Yeah.
And they'll put on a billion plugins to try to do it. But then you watch the good ones and they go and they're like, nope, I'm going to move the mic here.
Yep.
Or I'm going to move this. And that's what I think a studio allows you to do is you get to have that.
You have a good snare, a good player, and a good mic, and you know what to do. And it's like,
keep
it simple, stupid.
Then I'll like start to put the little accoutrements on.
Exactly.
Well, that's
exactly.
Cool. I mean, this is, I love, I've never been a studio guy, never mixed on a console in a studio.
Yeah.
But to be in them, there is magic. Yeah. And especially when you think about some of the iconic songs that came out of them. And I think like bands, I think rock bands especially, started to go back and think about that. And even some country guys, We're like, where can we go where great albums were made back in like the 60s and 70s and 80s?
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. It was fun to record this in this new studio in New York or whatever, but let's go back.
Speaking of, I mean, literally next door is RCA Studio A and B, which...
Nothing got recorded there, right?
and literally almost got tore down, right? I mean...
To build a hotel, probably,
right? To build a hotel. Jeez. They had bulldozers sitting out front of it, and guys saved in the middle of the night. And that Studio A was Chet Atkins' home studio for 30, I don't know how much, 40 years. It was built in like 63 or 64. And I, on top of being a vintage guitar collector...
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I collect RCA things from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s,
really?
Like radio-related, tube-related
no
technology,
way.
And I've sold them like some signs and some lights from the 50s and 60s that have been over there, but I've never been in that room. So
really?
I drive by it, literally our parking lot like butts up to them. And like that huge RCA with the nipper dog,
mm-hmm.
like I have all those. And if you were to go in my bedroom, you'd be like, okay, that's right. Why you're not married. And that's what, like, it's ridiculous, but I've never been in there. And I know that's like at this point, one of the biggest rooms left in town. And Dave Cobb is over there. So unless you're working directly with Dave Cobb,
mm-hmm.
you're not getting in that room, mm-hmm. you know? But I finally got to get in last week.
Did you really?
I got in.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And I mean, as ridiculous as it sounds, like I remember one day somebody delivered like Uber Eats to the studio
uh-huh.
here. And it was like on a Sunday. So nobody was here. And it was me and one of the other engineers. And it was like a food order for like 15 people. And I was like, okay, clearly somebody mm-hmm. dropped us off at the wrong place. So mm-hmm. it's Sunday. We're like, maybe it was another studio. So we're like, we're going to use this as an excuse to go over to RCA and like knock on the door and get in and like finally see the studio. So we get all this food and we go over and like knock on the studio door and like nobody's answering. It's like, okay, well. So finally, somebody did answer from like the office side
uh-huh.
because there are offices over there, and they're like, yeah, well, you can kind of like walk around and see if like, so we were able to like get in the offices and walk around, but like still we didn't get in the studio that day. I'm like, oh my, so close.
So close.
But Sammy Hagar had a listening event over there last week because he just cut his last record over there.
Man.
Dave Cobb, Vance Powell, all the heavy hitters. And Emily Ann Roberts, who is mm-hmm. one of the artists that Star Trek manages and who I play with mm-hmm. and TM with, and one of her kind of mutual people that she works with from Knoxville, her photographer, works with Sammy and is Sammy's photographer and does a bunch of day-to-day. And so she was like, man, you should come over. We're doing like this listening event. So I'm like, perfect.
I'm
here
in.
We go. I'm getting into RCA for the first time. And and there was
hold it together,
hold it together. I love Sammy and all. I just wanted to get into the room, you know.
Yeah.
Like I just wanted to see,
100%.
You know. So there's a bunch of industry people kind of filing in over
uh-huh.
there, and nobody knows how to get in because it's not. There's like one literal like just brown like painted door over there.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And I know that's the door because I.
Yep.
So there's a bunch of people, and I was like, oh, no, come on, everybody over here. Like, I know how to.
You've never been in there, but you know.
I know.
You know.
Knock on the door, and this time it opens up, and it's just like, there it is.
Man.
There it is. Like, there.
That is too good.
They have the tile, you know, the black and white tile on the floor. They have the original nipper dog sitting up there and everything, and it's just, it's incredible. It's one of the most iconic historic rooms, and it was just like a pinch me moment, and I got to meet all the RCA people over there, and it was just a really cool day.
And yet they wanted to tear it down. It's crazy.
I know.
It's insane to me. And that, I think that's awesome that there's people, though, like you that appreciate and truly take care of vintage stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something to be said. It's like, cool, here's a room here, but then just one block over, there's another room that's been around even longer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's had many, many more iconic things.
Oh my gosh.
And as much as it's like, okay, cool, we need a new hotel, we don't.
No.
Let's keep this. Let's keep Music Row somewhat Music Row-y, you know?
The reason people come to Nashville is
yeah.
to see that stuff, yeah. this stuff right here. So
yeah, you can't just put everything in a museum.
Yeah.
And I do think that, like you said, there are artists that are starting to find themselves going back and saying, okay,
mm-hmm.
let's go to an iconic room. Maybe we don't do every song there, but let's
right.
do our hit.
Yep.
The one that we think is going to
be the biggest.
Let's do something awesome there. And then, cool,
the Adobe Atmos room
is open. So let's go do the rest there.
Mm-hmm.
But you did one or two in this room, and then you can say, like, we recorded this awesome song with this awesome console.
Mm-hmm.
And they are awesome.
Yeah.
They're magical to look at because they're... For one, giant.
Yeah,
it's like looking at a small boat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, it's the Star Trek Enterprise.
Exactly.
Or is that the one? Yeah.
Exactly.
I never watched any of that stuff, but in my mind, yeah, it looks very like,
that's what it is.
Baseballish.
Yeah.
And so, what's this? The Dolby Atmos is a new technology, right?
Yeah, that's like all the 360 immersive audio. So, like,
go ahead and so it, would that be like headphones you're talking about?
Yeah. Okay. So, like, the AirPods,
mm-hmm.
the new AirPods, Teslas, the new Teslas, they all have this technology built into whatever the playback device is. And it will get to the point where every device that you buy moving forward, whether it's just like a little bar for your TV or, you know, a different brand of headphones, it'll all be capable of playing.
Oh, wow.
This playback.
Okay.
But it's 3D audio, so in the point of, if you think of a standard like stereo mix as like two-dimensional, this is 3D. So if you want a sound, if you want, say you put like a tap delay on a guitar tone, and you want that delay trail to spin around your head and feel like it's going up and down, or you can do that. Or if you want to sound like there's a train coming from behind you from like 10 miles away that's getting closer and closer and closer. It allows you to do all that. And think of music is in a sense of like almost objects.
Mm-hmm.
So you have certain sounds and there's certain objects and you move them in this 3D sphere that you're consuming or listening to.
Yeah, because before that, all that was really there was like 5.1 or 7.1.
Exactly.
And that's really only taking, because like in a standard thing, you'll have a left and a right.
Yep.
And then you have a pan knob that can go, well, and then you had the center too if you wanted to. And you just use this knob to go left, center, or right.
Yep.
And that gave space, but then 5.1 hit.
Yep.
So then you could go left, right. And then you could go left behind or right behind.
Yep.
And then, or you could go center.
Yep.
Or you could go all of them.
Yep, exactly.
And then the sub was the point.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're saying that what they've added in is top, bottom, middle.
Yeah. It's up to like 12 different, you know.
Yeah. And I think that that's cool because, you know, maybe you just walking down the street listening to your favorite Bon Jovi song doesn't, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But you listening to a new, really cool spatial Kanye West.
Yeah.
Who knows what, because he puts stuff everywhere.
And so that's a really good debate because it will change the way people record in the sense that they know that's going to get mixed that way. So we're going to set up a microphone here, which is going to capture this sound, you know. But they said one of the coolest listening experiences so far to date is Miles Davis, Kind of Blue.
Really?
Which?
And like an old recording of it?
Yes, so you're thinking, okay, well, now there's like, how did they do that? Because that was recorded, I think, on like a 3-track.
Whoa.
So this is going to blow your mind. They went to Capitol Records, and they set up, they took the original tapes, pulled them out, and they set up a bunch of speakers in the room all over and then set up microphones at certain places and re-recorded, played back the album and re-recorded it.
Whoa.
So now they have from Capitol with all their mics and, you know, they have all the different shapes to be able to use and to spread around. And they said it's the most like tasteful musical example right now that's not like hokey pokey, but like.
Yeah, because you could get real.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I could see where hokey pokey could really like you're like, oh, there's some symbol just off in the freaking distance that makes no sense because the artist wanted it there.
Right.
But take something like iconic, like a Miles Davis song, and then truly give it depth.
Yep.
And then give it that space.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it's breathing. You're like, whoa.
Yeah. I heard Here Comes the Sun Beatles the other day.
Oh,
in our room actually. And it was the first one that I think because I've been so consumed with the kind of process of getting the room built that I haven't really sat down and been like, okay, I want to hear this now because it's just been like, oh my gosh. And I finally, just literally yesterday, they opened up the speakers and it was Here Comes the Sun, you know. Okay, oh, that's God. A song that I'm
familiar with, yeah.
Right, you know.
We've all heard it.
And, you know, the acoustic guitar intro part comes in and it's sitting there. And then that synth sound that sweeps over you before the first verse, mm-hmm. that, I mean, you know when you hear it, you're like, okay, yeah, I know that part. All of a sudden just felt like it just like came out of nowhere and just like was a blanket that just like came and just was like, shoot, there we go. It just came out of nowhere. And
you got that?
Let's see.
Might have to tighten a bolt or two there.
The blanket came in
and
hugged me too hard.
It moved the mic. It hugged you so hard it moved the mic.
Yeah. And it literally just, it felt like it was all over me.
Oh, that's
then,
cool.
Boom, verse drops. And it was like, it was a really, really cool moment.
That is cool. There's just something to be said about the technology behind that, but then taking something that is cherished like that and mm-hmm. then just giving it appreciation.
Which is another even level of like, whoever is working and kind mm-hmm. of interpreting these, there's that level of, okay, this is the Beatles. Don't. Yeah. Don't screw this up, you know. Like,
well,
don't,
yeah.
And don't do too much.
Mm-hmm. You know what's funny is I'm not a Beatles person.
Really?
Nah.
Why?
I don't know why. I just never have been. I appreciate them.
Who's your favorite Beatle?
I honestly couldn't. What is it, Paul?
Can you name the four Beatles?
The one that they, whoever Paul is, I like him because I think he had the Live and Let Die song.
He did, yeah. Wow. So you're, I mean, have you... Has it been intentional to be a non-Beatles guy at this point?
No,
because
I'm just not a music. What's crazy is we'll have an intense conversation about music, but yeah. I'm not a music person.
Okay.
I'm just not like,
okay.
I like it. It does good things for me. It cheers me up. But I think I always wanted to be in the industry for just something completely outside of why music is made and stuff like that. So over the years I've learned and I've started to appreciate it more. But yeah, the Beatles were, I think because my mom was more probably Led Zeppelin based.
Yeah.
And so that like,
do you
gritty,
like Led Zeppelin?
I like Led Zeppelin. I mean, I'm a Led Zeppelin. I would say that I'm not like a fan, but I like stuff like
oh,
that.
Oh, I'm a fanboy.
Are you? I got to see Robert Plant and Jimmy Page when I was a kid. And I was pretty blown away at a young age at what they could do with instruments.
That's, I don't want to like open a can of worms here, but Plant and Page both. Jimmy Page handed me my college diploma.
No way.
Yeah. He was, when I graduated in 2014, he was our guest speaker.
Oh my gosh.
And it was like, what in the world, Jimmy Page? And he handed us our diploma and his cap and gown and everything. It was crazy.
And you kept it together?
I kept it together. Yeah.
And, were you a fan at a young age, I'm assuming?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. They were the first, you know, I mean, I've always loved the Beatles and whatnot, but it was Led Zeppelin that.
Yeah.
Wear the t-shirts at school every day, you know, like.
The sound is just something, it's different. It really is different. It's something that's, I don't know, there's something maybe this is it. Maybe a Beatles songs never excited me. I understood them, but never did I ever want to go to a bar and put on.
Yeah.
But.
Hey Jude.
Being in a, yeah. no, yeah, exactly. No. But going to a bar and drinking beer all day. I could definitely listen to some Led Zeppelin songs while playing pool and
hell
smoking
yeah.
cigarettes
yeah.
and just having a
immigrant song just in your face.
100%. But yeah, the Hey Jude, no.
Yeah, yeah.
And people always look at me like, are you kidding me? But what if, and I'm like, look, I get it. I like them, but
yeah. yeah. So Robert Plant,
uh-huh.
I grew up in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. That's why we're drinking Yingling.
That's right. Shout out to Yingling, yep, America's oldest brewery.
America's oldest brewery.
Let's see what year.
1829.
Pottsville, Pennsylvania.
Ooh.
That's a long.
Is that close to you?
Probably an hour away.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm from Williamsport, roughly, which right. is home of Little League Baseball.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Well, we'll hit on the little baseball.
Yeah,
I actually lived in Lidditz, Pennsylvania for 6 months, 7 months.
Which is about an hour and a half for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I've never actually been there, but.
A lot of rock and roll.
A lot of rock and roll, yeah.
Blair Brothers.
That's where it's at.
Yeah, that's where I worked for 12 years.
That's so cool. I didn't realize they actually stationed you up there.
You had to go and learn.
some of their systems and stuff.
Oh, that's
like
where they teach
that.
It up there?
Yeah, yeah. So okay. even if you're like the smartest roadie in the world, they still put you still through some of their training.
Cool.
Just because they want it to be legit.
There's not much going on up there. I mean,
not sure. when I went through there, not any, but nowadays
it's grown a little bit.
Oh my gosh. Like they built like a big studio up there to do, like rehearsals for big, like you could put on a full on arena
rehearsal
or stadium tour inside their buildings and it do everything you need. And
that's so cool.
Yeah. I think, either Usher or Taylor Swift, one of those was like the first, and that really brought a lot of attention. And then after that skyrocketed.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So Robert Plant.
Yeah. So Robert Plant grew up in Pennsylvania, and there was this guy, his name Mick. He would come and see my like high school rock band play in clubs and stuff. And he was like, you know, you guys are cool and everything, but your amps sound like this shit. You know, that's awful. And he was thank you.
Well, thank you and thank you.
Thank you and thank you. but he was like, you know, come on over to my house. And he goes, I can help you, you know, like maybe we can get an old amp and we can recap it, go through it, whatever, or we can, he's like, I can build some amps. And he was just, you know, an amp guy. So I go over to his house and, he was an old rock and roll guy and kind of from the DC area and played, in Evan Johnson, the H Bombs, which was like a punkabilly rockabilly kind of underground 70s, 80s, 90s group. And he, you know, played with a various group of artists and whatnot, and then started studying kind of with like Cesar Diaz, who was Stevie Ray Vaughan's guitar tech from the DC area. And he would, you know, popping into his shop, and he was getting all the Gerald Weber books and just, you know, really digging in. And so I started going over to his house, and it became like in the summertime for 3, 4, 5 years, every day I'd go over. And we started buying like old 40s, 50s, 60s Fender, Valco, Gibson type of amps, and just, and just going through them and recapping them and fixing
what's
them
what's recapping
up
them, just so?
Like the capacitors inside, which are basically like kind of like the batteries, really, if you think about it. Those are some of the general components that for a piece of electronics from 50, 60 years, you know, they maybe will last 10 or 20 years. So going through and changing the components that needed to and getting the amps up and going. And then it was like, well, let's start building some of our own amps. So we got to the point where we were building like Harding Deluxes, which is my last name and everything. And, Robert Plant was playing in Scranton, and he was with his band, Sensational Space Shifters, I think, at that time. And me and my friend were just like, we're going to go, you know, like, of course, if Plant is coming within,
why not?
So we go, and I remember it was at a casino, and it was a big arena, and show was awesome. And afterwards we were like, man, let's like try to like wait and find like where his tour bus is and hang out, and like we're gonna meet Robert Plant and everything. And couldn't find anything. We did a like a loop around the building and didn't see anything. So we were like, okay, we're just gonna go back to our hotel, which is just 5 minutes down the road. Well, we go to the hotel that we're at, and I look over at the hotel bar, and there's Robert Plant's entire band sitting in there. I'm
that's
like,
so awesome.
What is going on right now? So I go to my friend. I was like, well, we're going to go over and hang with them. And it's the whole band, but Robert isn't there at this point. So I sit down by his guitar player, who at the time had a 1952 Gibson Les Paul Gold Top. And I saw it like from the audience. I was like, oh, shoot, that thing's killer. That's so cool. And geeking out to that. So that was my icebreaker, you know. And and I noticed that he
got to have an icebreaker.
That's right. You got to have something.
Can't just walk up and
exactly. So get him with that. And I noticed he was playing like some modern Fender amps and whatnot. And, you know, so I kind of was asking him about that. And I said, you know, I've been building some amps and everything. And I was like, I'll give you one, basically.
Yeah.
And he was like, no,
no,
don't do that.
You're like, no, it's
no,
cool.
Like, seriously, I will. And he was like, no. Well, at this point, over my left shoulder, it comes Robert Plant and like literally just sits down right beside me. I'm like, oh, shoot. Now what? Like, I am just melting inside. So we sit there, we hang out, and it's cool. We drink a couple beers and everything. And his guitar player, Justin, I said, you know, hey, it was nice meeting you. I'll shoot you a message. So I found him on Facebook, shot him a message. And finally he was like, okay, send me an amp. So we send one over to England, and I get a photo then like a week or two later, and Justin is in Brian Eno's studio, and Brian Eno is like all the U2 stuff, like, you know, guitar tone god over there, you know, and there's Justin with holding the amp with Brian Eno, like giving a thumbs up. And I was like, oh, shit.
That is so cool.
It's so cool. So
did you ever see it on stage with him?
So for the next like 5, 6, 7, 8 years, basically the couple of the studio albums that Plant used, a bunch of the 3 or 4 of the world tours, he had 2 or 3 of the amps that I built up there on stage at all times. If you zoom in on the logo, you can see Harding on it. But
oh, that's cool.
I got to get really close with the guys in the band and got to hang with Robert on a couple occasions. And, you know, they would always do an after show, like hang at their shows. And
yeah,
it was really interesting, like, because Plant would play down in, like, the Deep South, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. He would love to go and play those little theaters. And the after show party at that was, you know, like a little cinder block room, and it was the band and like me and my mom and like his photographer, just like, but then you'd go and he'd play in like LA or something at the Hollywood Palladium, and the after part, like Priscilla Presley's there, and all the groupies are there, and it's like, oh my gosh, what is this?
What
you know,
is going on here?
So yeah, it's been a really cool thing, and still close with the guys.
Really?
And Plant just put out the record with Alison Krauss.
I was going to say, one of my favorite things that he does is stuff with Alison Krauss. Her voice and then him are just...
It's incredible.
It's two... Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
It's like two angels singing.
They're going on tour this year. Not so playing in Nashville, which I'm bummed about, but June 16th, which is my birthday, they're playing in Atlanta, so I'll be going to that show.
So I know where you'll be.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. That is super cool. Did you ever, all right, as a fan, were you, I mean, obviously, you try to hold it together, but were you ever able to ask him, like, a fanboy question? Like,
I mean,
what was it like to be in rock and roll in 1978?
Right. There was a couple times where he was telling some old Zeppelin stories, like, and I was sitting in the room, or a situation where there was a couple acoustic guitars around and everybody just like kind of picked up some guitars and started jamming. And I was like, whoa, like I'm, you know, goosebumps type of deal. So,
and those moments aren't captured. You know, those are the best moments that you get to hold on to for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
That you can tell the story a million times, but being in the room
is
something unreal.
Yeah. And like you said, it wasn't captured on film or anything. And that's the beauty of it.
That is the beauty of it. Know? I think that's why being in a room like a studio is really interesting, because you look at the room and there's windows, but there's really not windows to look in.
That's so true.
There's a little slit in the door. There's a window that you can see out onto the street, but no one can see in.
It's what a very here
yeah,
is,
it's a private event. And so a dressing room is very studio-esque as well, because you close the door and the stories that come out, especially from those old guys. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, the one show as that was the New Orleans Jazz Festival.
Ooh, I bet that was cool.
Yeah, and one of the promoters from that show was like an ex-Zeppelin Day promoter, so like him and Plant were hanging out and just, you know, sharing stories, and it was just like, whoa.
I mean, that's so cool, though. Wow. Here you are, Pennsylvania. You know, and Pennsylvania's been around forever, and there's a lot of things that come out of Pennsylvania.
Totally.
But, you know, being a kid, you're just starting fresh like everybody else. You're like, man, what would it be like to just meet these guys? And here you are. You're like, well, they're playing. You want to go try and meet them? And then you're like, oh, man, we didn't meet them. Let's just go back to the hotel. Boom. There they are. You're like, what?
Changed my life.
Yeah, you know? Because all of a sudden it's like there's inspiration in that too. It's not just the fact that you got to meet one of your idols. It's the fact that, well, you went out on the limb and said, do you want to play my amp? And he said no. But you're like, I think you should just give it a try. Believe me. Let me send you. And then all of a sudden he loves it.
Yeah.
You're like, bam, this is amazing.
Anything is possible. You just got to do it.
Yeah.
You just got to
put yourself out there a little bit. Try.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how long did you live in Pennsylvania before you made this jump to Nashville now?
Let's see here. I moved to Nashville 2014.
Okay.
So I've been here 7 years, I guess.
Were you like 20 when you moved here?
Yeah, I guess it was 21 probably.
21, okay.
Yeah, I just had graduated. I went to Penn State for a little bit.
Did you really?
Went to
Cougar? Is it are they Cougars?
Nittany Lions. Which
Lions,
basically. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew it was one of those those cats.
Yeah. And everybody's always like, "What? Do you have them up there?" I'm like, "We did." But like, there was an extinct species. We used to have mountain lions up there.
Yeah.
So it's technically a mountain lion. But I did go to Penn State for a year and a half doing English education.
Yeah.
And
hated it the whole time, I'm sure.
Not hated it, maybe, but just it wasn't you.
Oh, boy. It was, yeah. And in school, always was a... It just kind of came naturally to me. Yeah. I was always got good grades, all the things, and I was doing very well at Penn State, and it was just not a challenge, and I didn't want to be there. I wasn't happy.
Music was calling you.
Yeah, and all I could do at Penn State was play in the blue band, marching band. I'm like, no. So
what year did you I did get kicked out of a bar in Penn State.
Which one?
I think it's like Froggies or Frogs or... it was a long night.
It's probably one of the university bars.
It was, it was 100% on the strip. And they,
that's hilarious.
Yeah, it was. I didn't want to go out that night. And the guy that was the front of house guy, he was like, come on, dude, just come have one beer. And I show up and there was a beer and a shot of like Rumpelmans. And I was like, oh, yeah, this night's over. Good night. And I ended up like, I remember I woke up on the bus in my boxers in the front lounge because had like 2 days off. So, like, and I shouldn't even been on the. I had a hotel room that night, but here I am laying
on the bus. Your boxers,
a mess.
It's a party town.
I had fun.
State College. I mean,
I had a blast.
Yeah,
I've been back to that bar since. They didn't remember me, thank gosh. But
there he is. Yeah.
There's that guy. They thought I was like doing or. The one night I wasn't doing blow in a bathroom, like they thought I was. Yeah, I was like, I'm not. They're like, yeah, well, there's reports that you are. I was like, I don't know who's reporting me, but I'd be a lot more sneakier if I was. So yeah, that will always be one of my high memories of
Penn State.
Yeah,
I love that.
I've been there a bunch of good times. But so I want to ask you, since you talk about these guitar amps and stuff, what year was the first time you ever picked up a guitar? Do you remember?
I was, I think, 6.
Wow. So,
I was born in,
so it really has been in your blood.
Yeah, I was born in 91, so yeah. And I remember because I had my first guitar lesson, and then like the next day I broke my thumb. I dropped a bowling ball on it, and it's still like you can see the like how there's like a permanent crack in my nail there. And I couldn't play guitar for like however long then.
Yeah,
like, so I was like 6 and my parents were like, you got to pick one instrument. We don't care what it is, you know, to me and my sister. Mm-hmm. And she chose piano and I chose guitar. My cousin played guitar.
Okay.
And it just kind of stuck. I don't know. I loved it. I became just obsessed with it and, you know.
Was it an acoustic first or was it an electric?
Yeah, I got a Gibson Les Paul, one of those mini little ones, because I was probably only
little guy,
3.5 feet or something.
So. Yeah, you couldn't hold a big old guitar yet.
Yeah, so that was it, and then I took lessons throughout school, high school, and it just kept going and going, and it got to the point where it was like, if I don't do something music, mm-hmm. guitar related, mm-hmm. and doesn't necessarily mean sitting down practicing, but something in that vein or in that world, I didn't feel a sense of accomplishment for the day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So there, here you are in school, learning about English, and you're like, all I want to do is just go play my guitar.
Yeah. And it's crazy. Like, you can sit down for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, play something, work on something, be constructive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I can pat myself on it. Like, it's that small, but it gives me that sense of do good or accomplish
learning different chord progressions, I'm sure, and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and
hear a song that you like and like just what was that, or you know. And I tell people all the time too, I think I love sports,
mm-hmm.
love baseball, but music is something that it doesn't matter whether you're 6
mm-hmm.
or 86, if you want to sit down and work out a song or work out mm-hmm. a whatever, you can do it.
Yeah.
Can't do that with sports.
No.
There's a lot of things in life that, you know, as you get older, things change physically, mentally, this, that, or the other. But music, it's the universal language, you know.
Yeah. You can hum something there your whole life, whistle something.
Absolutely. And that's what's so cool about being in music is that you can keep growing with this. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what year you started.
Yeah.
You can keep getting better and keep growing.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at what you just said earlier. Here's Sammy Hagar. How long has he been in the industry?
Yeah, he's 74.
40 years?
Yeah.
50 probably years maybe? Been, maybe
yeah,
even longer?
50 years.
Here he is putting out another album.
Yep.
I mean, that just goes to show you that even though, And I've always heard this argument too, because, you know, I've had friends that built records and stuff like that, or a part of a record. And one of them was a part of a record that, you know, and it was GNR, you know, their last one was what, like Use Your Illusion 2, right? Yeah. And then they took all this time off. And my buddy Karam was part of the album that came, the Chinese Democracy, right?
It took 12 years.
Yeah. And everybody was like, oh, you know, they reviewed it however they wanted to review it. And Karam had said something to me, and they might, this isn't a quote by any means, but he was just like, well, yeah, but that Axl's not Axl. You know, people grow and music grows. And I think that even though you might love Led Zeppelin, 1974 Led Zeppelin or whatever, look, these guys are still creating new music and it's not the same. It's different.
Plant's the epitome of that too, because he's, you know, they did the Zeppelin reunion show.
Yeah.
And everybody, like, still to this day are like, it's like they're mad at, like, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page for not touring, you know? And it's like, I feel like Plant says it best. He's like, there's no need to recreate, you know?
It's already out there.
We did it. Yeah. We did it. And they did do one reunion show, which was awesome.
Yeah, of course.
And that's great. That's the cherry on top.
Boom.
And that's it. And Plant, as an artist, wants to keep growing.
And when, I think that is, you know, the thing. It's growth. Being an artist is
new music, new sounds, play with new people, and growing as an artist. And that's cool.
It's hard for fans, though.
It's hard for fans. It. For the general, you know.
Yeah, because you love a song. Yeah. You're like, oh, I can't wait to hear 10 more just like this.
Yeah.
But if they do 10 more just like that, they'll go away.
Exactly.
They'll be done. They will fizzle because they're not growing with how trends are growing and people. Mm-hmm. You know, and then technology is growing too. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, why would they ever go record in the Dolby Atmos room?
Right.
Well, because one day your headphones will have that technology.
It will. Yeah.
Even though you think that you're never going to, like, that's my thing that I always tell my parents. Even though you think that you'll never buy that piece of technology, you'll be forced to one day, whether you like it or not, just because
it or not, you know, it's,
well, yeah. And things die, like, you know, like your car is going to die. So one day you might potentially, even if you hate electric cars,
sorry,
might have to buy an electric car.
Sorry. Yep. And sorry, not
the,
sorry.
Well, and the reality is too, is that it's like, you know, cars too, like, as even though it might be a gas car now, is way harder to work on today than it was in 1979.
Totally.
So you just have things like that change. And so I think music, like, growing as from where you were at six, I mean, think about the musician you are now.
Yeah. It's cool. A lot of cool things have happened.
Learned a lot from people.
Yeah. And I'm 30 now. And if I go till I'm 90, that's just one third of, you know, it's just beginning.
So I've cool. I always it's say cool. I've lived like at least two lives already. And I'm just starting. When I hit 40, I'll start like my third, because everything's changing, you know, whatever.
It is. You know.
I'm changing. I'm not the same PK I was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the insane part. So, yeah. I mean, I love it. I was really excited thinking about this because, you know, you're from a younger, like, you know, generation. Mm-hmm. But here you are collecting vintage guitars from the freak you just showed. What year is the one that you just showed me?
Both of those over there are 52 Tellys.
Oh my god. We'll show them at the end.
Yeah, we'll give them some airtime so that way fans out there can see this.
Yeah.
But yeah, the vintage guitars, that was the real kicker that for me that got the fuel going and was kind of the glue between playing and being out on the road and tour managing and running the studio. The one kind of constant thing that always kept, I was telling you, I said, like, I have a Reverb eBay Craigslist like routine, you know, like I've got the keywords, you search them every day, you know, and it's ridiculous. But that is the one thing that from the beginning of time, you know, I got obsessed with old things, and my parents were always kind of collectors in general. And the one that's over there that has all the carvings and signatures on it, Mick, the amp guy, that was his road guitar back in the day.
Oh, wow.
And everybody who they played with carved their name into that. So,
no way.
So that guitar has everybody from Jerry Lee Lewis and Minnie Pearl to Jello Biafra, and both the Ramones are on there. And
no way.
Because they were in like that punkabilly, rockabilly country scene. So they were.
And being that close to New York and stuff. I mean,
they were playing CBGBs and all that kind of stuff back then. And that guitar, there's all kinds of old photos of it back in the day. And when I turned 21, Mick
gave that to me.
No way.
And it was just like, oh, shit. Wow. Like, I literally have goosebumps right now even thinking about
that's
it. It
so
was just,
cool.
It changed my life.
If was that your first vintage that you would... were able to truly say like this is gonna start an obsession.
Yeah. I remember he was like, yeah, I've got one of those in the closet. I maybe like mentioned one day where we were building amps and he's like, yeah, I've got one of those in the closet. And I'm like, I've known you for a couple years and like how are you just telling me about this? So he's like, I'll pull it out at some point.
And it's a specific style that you like too. It's the Fender Telecaster.
From 1950, mm-hmm. 49 prototypes, 1950 through 54, Fender Black Guards, which refers to the black pick guard, the Telecasters.
Okay. Yeah.
And it could be a Broadcaster, an Esquire, no caster, Telecaster. But essentially, they're what we know as the Telecaster
body style
with the black pick guard. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that I just have been obsessed with, and they've changed my life. So he gifted that to me when I turned 21. It was just like off
Gears,
to the races,
yeah.
You know?
Gone.
And I was in college at the time, and I was able to find old beat up ones on Craigslist that somebody had painted, you know. I remember one specifically. The guy routed the back body. So he, you know, plank of a Telecaster, he contoured it like a Strat and did an awful job, like with, you know, like his belt sander out back of his trailer, you know, type of deal. He stripped the finish down and with silver paint across the body, he painted Slack, S-L-A-C-H. I don't know if that was his name.
Oh, man.
And it just looked awful. The fingerboard was maple. He painted it black.
Oh,
and where
gosh.
The dots were, he painted white Chevy emblems. And I saw this guitar on Craigslist, and they were asking, I think, like $4,500 for it. And this is early 2000s, probably, or early 2010s, I guess.
Yeah.
And I remember showing Mick that guitar, and he's like, no, like, that thing is trashed, you know? But I knew, like, the control plate on that was probably worth, like, $400. That pickguard was probably worth, like, $1,500. Those tuners were. So I started, like, buying these examples that were beyond restoration.
Mm-hmm.
And I would part them out as I was in college. And
smart.
I was selling them on eBay and, like, taking a guitar that I paid $4,500 for and selling $10,000 worth of parts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The smart way.
The smart way.
Yeah, yeah.
And then prices got to the point where those $4,500 guitars were 10 grand for that condition and 15 in price. So I couldn't do it. And I got to the point where I was buying nicer and nicer examples. So I didn't need part. And it just kept growing and growing. And
that's awesome.
I paid off all my college debt by flipping Telecasters.
That's amazing.
Yeah, just
now, was the Telecaster your first electric guitar that you owned?
No.
No.
Okay,
you just became obsessed with it.
Just became obsessed with it, yeah.
Wow.
And I don't know why. I mean, Mick gifted me that one.
And then it kind of just started the whole... They're beautiful. I think that to me, though, they are very iconic when you see it. You're like, you know, you're just like, oh, that is...
Even if you don't know anything about guitar or music, you see that body shape, that headstock shape, and you're like,
yeah,
you know. Fender started in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
Gibson started in the 1800s. So Leo Fender, like, started building radios with his dad in the 30s, you know.
Isn't that wild?
And started this company building little lap steels and amplifiers. And if you take the necks off those guitars, here's what's really cool too. So a Gibson neck is glued on. You can't take the neck off of a Gibson. With four screws, you can take that neck off that guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Inside the neck cavity and the body cavity is handwritten the date that it was built.
Really?
And the initials of the builder.
Oh.
So.
Is there a certain builder
Yes.
Okay.
TG. Taddeo Gomez is the guy. If you got one that's got the TG initials, which that one does on the body and neck, you've like.
Die. All right. All right.
So they had this like level of personality, like a personal, this was hand built.
Yeah.
That Gibson didn't have. And like all these little quirks and traits that just draws you in even more to the Fender story, you know? And
that is awesome.
I
never knew that.
Yeah. I always joke Leo Fender and his foreman was Forrest White. They're like, if you were to ask me who are my two biggest influences in life, hands down,
right there,
I'd say Leo Fender and Forrest White.
Whoa.
To the point where I want to name like my first kid Leo and Forrest, but I have this struggle, internal struggle, because the true guitar nerds will know, but everybody else will think I just named my kid after Leonardo DiCaprio and Forrest Gump.
I would have never gone there, but that's pretty funny. I could see where someone would.
This
think
is how
that.
Sick my brain is when I'm sitting at night thinking about guitars and all this stuff.
That's awesome. Where is Fender made?
California. Yeah,
been there since day one.
Yeah. Yeah, they're still out there, and they have multiple plants, but it was right out in California that they started, and yeah.
So him and his dad building radios, and then mm-hmm. they, in their garage, I'm assuming, and then they slowly
His dad had a repair shop.
Oh, okay.
So he was a young tyke kicking around.
Just learning,
and his first business was actually, it was like Leo Fender, and all the Fender nerds that are watching this are going to say I butchered it, but I think it was Radio Sales was the name of his shop. But he had a public broadcast amp cart that he made that he could roll around that had a public, it was a public address system.
Whoa.
It had a set of speakers and a mic and a little amplifier. And he would go to like the local Little League games and he would announce.
That's awesome.
And it would have like, you know, as the innings would switch over, is like, this baseball game is brought to you by Fender. And he would do all that stuff. And like, if there was a parade,
oh my gosh,
he would have the PA that would go down the parade. And like,
I'm sure there's a video of this somewhere, probably.
There's photos of it that exist. Oh my gosh. And he just kept growing. And then he started building amplifiers. Leo Fender couldn't play an instrument, musically illiterate. Also was blind in one eye.
Okay.
The story is so funny. He would sit there and he never threw anything away. He had a pocket protector and he would put his pens in there and he had a styrofoam cup that he'd drink his coffee out of. He'd refill the same cup every day because he didn't want to throw a cup away or whatnot. And he would sit there and this is in Forrest White's book. He would be working on an amplifier and he'd have a lap steel plugged in, right? And he said like Leo would just turn it all the way up and like sit there and test it. And he would just rake his hands. And Forrest was like, you would sit there and you just all day just hear this like, oh my God. So finally Forrest one day on Leo's lunch break, he went over and he tuned the lap steel into open tuning. So when he did that, it played a chord.
At least did so.
And Leo came back and was like, what did you do? Like... It just blew his mind. He was like just blown away by it, you know.
He's like, I finally hit the right chords. He's like, I don't know what I did, but it sounds magical in there now.
When I heard that story, I was just like, oh man, it just gives you a good snippet into what Leo Fender is all about, you know.
Family and fun, it sounds like.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that that's some of the
it's so true.
As I get older, some of the keys that I keep getting handed to me are not any other knowledge drops than just family and fun. So if you're doing those things and somehow you find a niche, go for it. Keep going.
He sold the company in 1964 to CBS, the TV company.
Okay.
And in Forrest White's book, that he tells like the last day that like he sees Leo drive out of the factory and the gates. I'm like about to cry right now. And I'm like reading this book just sobbing in bed, like thinking about, gosh. And it's so sad, but he sold and he cashed out and he built the rest of his life. He started G&L Guitar Company, which was George and Fullerton and Leo Fender. And he kept going. He lived till he was, I don't know, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. He passed away. He was in his, I think, 80s maybe or high 70s.
And, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, is that why certain Fenders are more special and it's usually the
term pre-CBS refers to roughly, now some instruments kind of span plus or minus a year, months or whatnot of that date, but generally 64 and back is the pre-CBS. That's what everybody wants. CBS came in and started...
You didn't get the signature in the headstock anymore, or in the on the body anymore. Probably
they changed the logo. A couple
little details started to slowly shift.
The amps started cutting costs, and it was like we can do this cheaper. Which
of course,
you know, all of a sudden things start happening.
Yeah, and it's sad, but at the same time, though, it's kind of cool because it adds in that like mystique, maybe that
to
like
when they got it right.
Yeah,
and I say this all the time. I think of like the 50s and early 60s. Mm-hmm. It was at a time where Leo Fender literally was building things to the highest top quality possible with the top components. If there was something better, he was going to go out and get it and build it in a way that the reason there's four screws on the neck of that guitar, mm-hmm. that Telecaster, is because his idea was if you wore the frets out of that guitar, mm-hmm. you didn't get a refret. That wasn't a thing. You would unscrew the neck and you'd write to Fender and he would send you a new neck and you'd just screw a new neck on.
Yeah.
The idea of maintenance and being easily fixed and easily repaired. And it happened at a time where the best components were available.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to do it on a small controlled scale.
Mm-hmm.
And for 10, 12, 14 years, like truly the stars aligned in production. And you would never be able to do that today.
No.
A, you can't get the same materials. B, you couldn't afford to run a business like that.
No.
You know?
It's unfortunate, but it is awesome because then there's the story of it forever. You know, and I think that's the key to a lot of stuff. It's like, yeah, as things change, but we can always go back to those awesome memories.
There are examples.
And you can, and we don't need to tear everything down. We can hold on to some things that are like this. You know, it's like the RCA.
Yeah.
You know, we continue to go back to that because it is important. Some of that stuff, maybe you never go into the building, but driving by it, you can at least like appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And even if you build 1,000 hotels around it, leave it alone. And then, you know, educate the younger generation about these guitars, because still to this day, we were talking about it and I was telling you, I was on tour and I know many guitar techs that went guitar hunting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's because there's these gems that were made and people just didn't realize it and put them.
They're out there still. And I, for so long, I've heard, oh, the younger generation are not going to be into vintage guitars. Like this is is the dad collector thing. You know, it's like, I truly have been trying to be an advocate to say this is not the case. I know so many people in their 20s and 30s that I could call right now who would drop 30, 40, 50K on a guitar, you know, on a vintage 50 or 60s.
Yeah. Well, and there's a different, and don't quote me on this, but there is a different sound to it.
Oh yeah.
Like there is 100% something special about what goes on through those from you hitting your fingers on the freaking strings on that fretboard, and then it travels down, and then it goes through those pickups and travels through the components.
Yeah.
It's different.
Yep. Yeah, it truly is. People who aren't as hip to it, I kind of tell them, go do it with like a vintage Martin, an acoustic guitar, because like an open-bodied sound coming from a guitar that the wood is 100 years old versus 10 years, you can really tell it. Sometimes when you're playing an electric, like if you're playing a loud arena or something, you know, it's like, it's a loud guitar. So sometimes that can get lost, but like truly the tone that you get from these examples, you just can't get.
That exactly is like, I've had that argument too on the road. It's like, we're in a room with 20,000 people.
Yeah.
The speakers are at 102 decibels. You as the engineer might hear these minute little things.
Mm-hmm.
The general person will never.
No.
But you know where they will? In their headphones.
Yes.
Or in their car while driving down the road. And then the difference between you recording in Studio B here and in your bathroom is monumental.
Correct.
And that's what this kind of, I think, this whole conversation is stating. It's like, cool, we're in this old room that's seen a lot. There's two guitars over there on a couch that are older than both of us combined.
Collectively 120 years old, right?
Yeah. And the magic that happens from those, I mean, think about that. The Ramones are on one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
they will outlive us too. And I tell people all the time, it's like, I don't own those guitars, just purely a caretaker.
Yeah.
Because in an ideal world, there will be another generation and another generation, and those things will keep going.
Well, Leo and Forrest.
That's right.
They're
going to have one for each.
I'm not kidding you, but that's the whole, that's the beauty of having a kid. And I think a lot of people mistake, like, oh, a kid's going to be like a pain. Yeah, of course they're a pain. They're a kid.
Somebody told me yesterday, and he was a mechanic, and he was fixing, I was watching this plumbing video on YouTube, and he literally said, quote, "Everything is a pain." And it's just like, it just resonated with me. It's like, if something is worth doing, it's a pain in the butt to do it. It doesn't matter.
Taking care of those guitars.
It's a pain. Everything's a pain.
Yeah. But the reward is, though, is that at the end of the day, that memory gets to live on forever now.
Yes. Yes.
Like, that is like such a cool thing. And like, that is what music is to a lot of people. Though I might not appreciate the Beatles, there's people that put on a song to the Beatles and tear up instantly or cry, fall down on the ground, whatever it is. And it's because of the care that they took while creating these albums and stuff like that.
Totally.
I love that you collect guitars. I think it's one of the coolest things. And growing up in Pennsylvania, I think you guys have some, it's like growing up on one coast or growing up on the other coast, there's something magical about it because there's these little venues. You know, it's like you go down to Southern California and there's like the hardcore scene, you know, that like grew like some awesome bands, you know. And then you are up in like Pennsylvania or New York, and then you like spent time at the Nova or the 930 Club or, you know, freaking Webster Hall in New York or all these places. And you get to see these guys who were like the Ramones playing guitars like this.
Totally. Williamsport, where I grew up, has a great music scene.
Yeah. Remember the, or I'm sure you've been to the Chameleon Club in Lancaster.
That's one of the most iconic rooms. I mean, seriously, on the East Coast, like if you're playing up that way, that's, you got to stop and hit that place. And
you do.
It really is kind of mind blowing how rich that area is in music.
There's a lot of music up there. There's a lot of great music that's come out from there. I just think, even though I may not be a music lover the way that like you are, looking at those, it's very, very, I can appreciate and say, wow, that is really cool. Speaking of the Telecaster, though, we were chatting about this. There's a few artists that are like dedicated to that too. Like in you see it more in country, right? But we were chatting about one guy, John Five.
Oh yeah.
And he plays that exclusively, right?
He's a Telecaster guy. If you get on Norm's Rare Guitars, which is a shop out in California, he has Guitar of the Day YouTube videos, hundreds, thousands of them. And there's videos of John, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, buying, I think it was Broadcaster serial number, like 0015 or something, like just one of the first Telecasters. And I mean, when you really dig around, there's some videos of him showing off his collection. I mean, he's got thousands of Telecasters and like cool custom shop stuff, but like vintage, like legit, legit stuff. And John Five, if you're out there, like we got to link up.
And he's not much older than me. So to, to say that it's only for or, you know, old dads and stuff like
that.
Yeah,
he's young. He's a young buck. And he's, man, he's got some incredible stuff.
Is there one thing of, someone, I brought him up on the show not too long ago, because it is something special. And the guy that I was talking to, he also does like, he songwrites and stuff like that. And so I was looking at his guitar collection and he had a Tele and I was just like, oh, that's awesome. John Five. He does like a double pickup something, right? Or is his Teles are just a tad different, the ones that he plays on stage, but he, I'm sure, doesn't touch the classics.
Yeah. He's, as we were talking with that like kill switch situation, all of his guitars are modified. He's got them all tricked out and everything, but he does have straight up like that Broadcaster and early Esquires and no casters that he'll play. I mean, he'll videos at his house, but he's not taking out on the road, you know?
And
so.
There's something cool too about him that I always explain. He does a style that is not rock and roll.
Oh yeah. He's, and what's really cool is when you see him play solo, because he does the best blend of like straight up shred metal, but then straight up like chicken picking country twang, you know,
inside of it together.
Yeah, like it's nuts because he can branch off and go and play straight ahead, just country licks in your face.
Isn't that amazing?
Like, it's crazy. He's an incredible guy.
Yeah, I would have to say, and to me, I if I had to choose a guitar player that I could enjoy just watching all day long, I would say him because, I don't know, there's just some, I've seen him live a few times. I've stood in, like, side stage. And and there is something just, like, really iconic about guys like him.
Oh, yeah. You know, he's like, one of the guys when he walks in the room, like, it's like, oh, shoot.
Yeah. Well, because he's not just playing. Because he's, if there's a guy that's going to be like, oh, no, I'm badass at guitar, he's going to be like, okay, that's fine. Let's see what you got. And he'll shred and
stomp
whatever and all that stuff. And then he'll be like, okay, cool, cool. Can you play this brand or can you do this style? Can you do this style?
Yeah.
And he's not going to, but he'll never do that. But he can.
He can.
And that's like just something cool is that in his bag of tricks, he has so many cool tricks.
And he plays literally from everybody from, you know, Rob Zombie to Marilyn Manson stuff to play, like he'll play country gigs and go out and, go in the studio and lay down country tracks. And so
who's one of your favorite guitar players of all time?
Telecaster-wise.
Yeah, we could stick to Telecaster-wise.
Yeah, I think that'll be a little more refined for me. I mean, one of the guys who owned that Brown signature guitar at one point was Danny Gatton.
Okay.
Who was one of the most famous unknown guitar players.
All right. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Big shout out, Danny.
Him in the Telecaster world, and there's a few of them, like Danny Gatton, Roy Buchanan.
Okay.
That were the Telecaster slingers and modern guys, not modern guys, he'll laugh when he hears this, but Red Volkart, who like played with Merle Haggard and whatnot, is probably, like, honestly, my favorite modern tele player is probably Red.
Nice.
And he's one of those guys that when he takes a solo, he's such a fun, quirky guy.
Uh-huh.
And when he plays, it's like he's having a conversation with you, like he's telling you a joke. Like you want to laugh after he takes a solo because it's just so just good and just so like he's having a conversation with you. You
That's
know?
Amazing.
And he's to me is like he's my favorite. I love Red.
He's the champ.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
Yeah.
I will say that though I do appreciate the Fender stuff. Like I said, I got to hold Billy Joel's.
Yeah.
Not Billy Joel, but Billy Joel. Billy Joe. Not Billy Joel. Billy Joe Armstrong's blue the BJ guitar from you know the Dookie albums and stuff like that, and I was like, there was something just magical about like something like that because he's had that since he was a kid. You know, in the back of it, there's a photo of him as a kid, and you're just like, that's really cool.
It's pretty amazing.
That is just awesome.
Yeah, the one guitar that I feel like at some point, if it ever comes up for like auction, you know, which will be the most expensive guitar, because I mean, there's been Hendrix guitars that have gone for sale, and, you know, David Gilmour just sold all of his stuff, like, a year and a half, 2 years. Like, the black Strat that he'd comfortably numb, like, he sold it. Brought,
whoa.
Like, I don't know, $3 million,
I saw them in 1994.
All those guitars he played on that show he no longer owns. He sold them all and donated all the money to, like, the environment.
Whoa.
And, that's like, awesome. World peace. It's good incredible. Yeah.
That just warms my heart.
It, seriously, good on you, bro. I love that. But Jimmy Page's 59 Gibson Les Paul.
Yeah, might sell a kidney for that one.
I mean, right? That's like $20-30 million guitar. Like,
might have to sell both of them.
Whoa!
I don't know if you'd survive. You'd never be able to play it.
That would be the one. Like, if you were to say, like, you could get one guitar, that one guitar, it'd be like, give me Jimmy's.
So that would be okay. So I was gonna pose this question to you. If you could play one guitar, through one amp, and choose two pedals for the rest of your life, what would it be?
It'd just be Jimmy's rig. Just which is that? I think he had like a phase flanger or something,
and
like and a tuner maybe. he may have had like a fuzz face or something, or like he had the blue box, the MXR situation, but just like one of his Marshall stacks.
Oh man,
with the Zoso logo on the front, right?
That would be it.
That'd be
right
sick.
In the front, right in the living room.
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't be able to afford anything else at this point. You would just if you bought it, like you'd have a room. You'd live in a room with an amp. And you'd be happy.
I wouldn't even live in the room. I'd be living in a box.
It'd be a safe.
Yeah.
You'd have to be in a bank safe just to make sure it was kept safe.
But that would be the one.
That would be the one. Yeah, all right. I always said.
What about you? What would you go for?
And I appreciate. Same way I appreciate the Beatles, the Tellys and the Fenders and all all those. The White Falcon was always, the Gretsch White Falcon to me was the most beautiful guitar I'd ever seen.
With the gold hardware?
With the gold hardware.
Yeah.
It had this different, it was almost like it wasn't a bright white, but like.
Oh, it's like that eggshell creamy just.
It's beautiful though. And what.
With the cream binding.
Yeah. And what ended
it
up like, and it had the whammy bar.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing that was really cool to me is as you played it, especially if you would see someone on stage with it, as the stage light would hit them, it would beam lights in different directions. Now, guitars do that, mm-hmm. but there was something brighter mm-hmm. about how this went. Yeah. Maybe it was the gold inlays that it would hit, or I don't know, but there's something beautiful about that guitar. I don't know how to play a guitar. I could probably, no, I can. I can do all like the heavy riff, you know, like
the junk rock.
The junk rock. Yeah. it would be that, or I always loved the Deans for some reason. The headstock on a Dean was just too cool.
I get it.
But I'm not a collector, so to me, I'm going for flash and trash. And they're not trash guitars by no means, but I'm going for the look,
flash,
you know.
Trash.
Yeah. You're going for, like, if someone saw those two guitars over there, be like, where'd you pull those out of? You're like, yeah, but those are way better than the two that I just named. And no effect, this is nothing to.
Yeah, not knocking Dean right now, right?
Or
Gibson. Yeah,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
But this is not anything like that. This is just like, those would be my two. Because you could still go out and buy a brand new Dean tomorrow if you wanted to. You couldn't go buy a 19.
Go,
you know,
go get Dimebag's guitar or something.
Oh, those are just gorgeous.
Yeah, that'd be sick.
And those, I mean, but I've brought him up on the show too, because he's one of those guitar players though. And I was explaining to my wife, if you listen to it, it sounds like there's 40 guitar players on stage.
Yeah.
And it's just him.
It's just him. It's just him.
And she's like, well, maybe he uses like a bunch of delay pedals. I'm like, no, he's not like setting up a song. He's not an Ed Sheeran where he's like setting up a tune and then hitting the repeat button and then doing it again.
He's got a looper up there.
No, he's not looping stuff on stage.
No.
Phil would have never allowed that.
Hell no. No, Dimebag is just, I mean, whoa.
And the reason I bring him up so much is because he is whoa. He's another John 5 that, you know.
Yes.
And I never saw Pantera. I've worked with guys who worked with them and saw him. And I mean, just phenomenal. You listen to some of those albums and you're just like, okay, there's 30 guitar players.
Yeah.
No, it's one.
Yeah.
One guy. And they probably recorded it in one studio with
probably
like two or three takes.
Probably in somebody's garage. Like, I mean, Dimebag, seriously, though, he's the real deal.
That's too. I love this guitar talk because
it goes everywhere from.
Well, it does, because you can just start down this like rabbit hole, and you can start with something like a vintage guitar that was played, you know, in the 50s by a guy.
I told you literally the one thing in my life that I feel like has opened up more doors or connections or more opportunities has been like vintage guitars.
I believe it.
It's weird.
I believe it 100%. There's something magical about what, because you can walk, like I was on the Queen tour mm-hmm. you know recently mm-hmm. and Brian May
yeah
mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't even know the brand he plays, but
he built it.
Okay, yeah, because I was gonna say I think he has like two mm-hmm. or maybe three mm-hmm. They're not something that I'd ever seen, but you watch him play on stage and you're like, dude, that guy's killing it. Mm-hmm. I've even heard girls that have no idea what a guitar amp is be like, whoa, that guy's like straight up destroying the stage.
So just
there's something about a guitar. Yeah,
there is. And when you're there and experiencing it, and Pete Townsend says it best, and you're saying what amp would you want to play through, but Pete Townsend's like, you haven't lived until you've stood in front of like a Marshall full stack and just like
mm-hmm.
you know, laid into it. And I think if you witness that, it doesn't matter if you're hearing music for the first time or whatnot, if you're in front of that or the one playing it or just an audience mm-hmm. member, how can you not be
pumped?
Yeah. How, like, you know,
it's a feeling that it's like stomping on the gas of an old car that goes fast, but not fast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, there's something very, very fun and mechanical happening right here.
Yeah. It's like the universal, just like chord that we can all is just like, you know,
I remember my buddy bought a 5150 EVH.
Mm-hmm.
It was that Eddie Van Halen's, mm-hmm. right? That was his.
Yeah.
And it was like it had come back out like in like early,
reissue.
Like maybe like 2009 or something, eight, like something like that.
Yeah.
And he let me stand in front of it and hit the strings. And I thought that I was like, whoa, that's incredible, because I had heard a guitar through an amp before, but never like that. And there was tone, there was bass, there was all these things, and I was just like, I didn't know a guitar could do this.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a lot of, for a lot of people, until you've had that reference, it's like, you only know what you know, you know? So like if you're used to plugging into a Blues Junior or something in your bedroom, that's what you know. So
until you hit those big boy strings.
And then once you do, you're like, there's no going back.
You can't. It's an addiction. It's like working out.
Yeah.
You know, or
once you've seen what is possible.
That's why guitar players have 400 pedals sometimes on the ground. It's not because they need all 400 at one time. It's because it's an obsession.
Yeah. 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 We love it.
Oh, okay. Here you are talking about Leo and
Forrest.
you're gonna teach him about guitars.
Yep.
We all hope and we can all dream and we can all like be like, man, I hope my kid does this or this. And at the end of the day, it really boils down to them. Right. But I think they'll have appreciation no matter what, right?
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that you can give them is your baseball love, right?
I just helped my parents move in Pennsylvania this past week.
Uh-huh.
And I literally brought my like baseball bag. I've got my glove. I've got my bats and I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
I'm like joking. I'm like, screw the kids. Like, I'm 30. I may have like 10 years left in my tank myself. I'm about to ready to go try out. Can I make the minor league team down here or what?
I've seen you many, many times in my life. We've gone to concerts before. We've lived together. Not like lived together, but we've been in many, many. I've never seen you wear a baseball hat.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
Not because you don't. Just maybe at work, you just never put on the hat.
Yeah.
But today you came around the corner and I was like, is he wearing a Yankees hat? I was like, and then you're like, dude, baseball started. And
oh,
I was
yeah.
Like, whoa, okay. Yeah. I did not notice that.
Post COVID.
Okay.
I started wearing hats during COVID and I was like, okay.
Kind of like him.
I dig that. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Cause I was going to say a lot of our time is spent pre COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the newer thing. But baseball, yeah. Obsessed with it. Yankees last night.
That's your team?
Top of the 11th.
How do you and BK get along? She's a Red Sox fan.
I know. I know. We've got Chris Alderman. He's in the building here.
We got a bunch
of Sox fans kicking around. And I went to school in Boston. So, like, I was at Fenway. All the Yankees, Red Sox games.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I went to all of them during my time up there. And, like, it was... oh, it was great. I bet I've seen more Yankees-Red Sox games than I'd like to admit, but... Man, I just like growing up in Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Philly, New York City was closer to us than Philly or Pittsburgh. So
that was okay. The
Phillies suck. I don't like the Steelers. I don't like the Eagles. So it was like New York
was kinda,
and my dad loved the Yankees growing up. So
who's your favorite Yankee?
Derek Jeter.
All time?
Number two.
Forever,
yeah. The captain.
From the inception of the Yankees to now, Derek Jeter. All right.
Yep. If Derek Jeter walked in the room right now, I would lose my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Never like, whoa.
Whoa.
Short of Leo, Fender, and Forrest, then Derek Jeter. Those are the three.
All right. What made you like Derek Jeter so much?
He was just at that age where he was a rookie in 96. Mm-hmm. I was like 5-6 years old.
Okay.
So
it just grew with
followed
him.
His whole career.
You got his jersey?
I mean, I've got like the Derek Jeter autograph baseball that still sits on my desk and it's ridiculous, but he just did it the right way.
Yeah.
He was no nonsense, never in the tabloid, like just always go to work, go play.
Do his job.
Do your job. And he was incredible. He was the captain, you know?
There is something to be said about, I really like the Spurs as a basketball team. And it's not because I'm a giant basketball fan. I like their mentality. Their coach, Greg Popovich, he always speaks to that. He's like, you know, I got to go into their locker room one time.
That's cool.
And I was expecting to walk in and see flat screens and Xboxes and all this stuff because I'd been in some other locker rooms and they're pretty fancy little things.
Yeah.
And I walked in and it was like, I don't remember the exact quote, but it basically said, like, shut up, come in and do your job. You get paid a lot of money.
Yep.
And it was tiny. It was a small room. It was like a studio. And and he liked it that way because it kept him close.
Yep.
When they were there to do one thing, and that's because they were making millions of dollars and win. Yeah.
Yep.
And I can agree with you that, I could see that about Jeter.
Yeah.
I never really heard about him. And
he just kept going and going, and that applies to life, like, truly. It's just...
Yeah. And now he's a commentator, right?
He actually owned the Marlins. He was a team... He just
Whoa.
Just sold the team. He's been partial team owner for 5-6 years now since he retired.
So he's on an island now, in other words.
I think he's probably on vacation right now, but he got inducted to the Hall of Fame last year. And, you know, so, yeah.
Are you going to go to any games this year?
Probably.
Probably?
Yeah, I'll make my way to New York at some point.
Since you live in Nashville now, I mean, do you go to the Sound?
I try to. Yeah. It's fun.
There's something about a baseball game.
They're
fun.
So fun, man. Going, you know.
Hot dog night?
Heck yeah. Is that Tuesday nights or something? I don't know. But
that's my favorite night.
We'll have to go. That'll be fun.
I would love that. When I was a kid, the El Paso Diablos were the small team.
The minor
league. Minor league, yeah. And they had like 25-cent hot dog night.
How could you not like that?
I wish I was 21 because then it would have been 25-cent hot dog and like probably $1.50 beer night for me. But there is something. I can't wait to take my little dude and little ones to. Well, and I mean, now I can say it, we're having like a little girl. So,
heck,
I mean, I'm just stoked that I get to do exactly what we've been talking about, is like show them little details of life.
Yep.
Whether they latch on to guitars or whether they latch on to baseball, that's not for me to determine that. But
right.
I would love to show them the love inside of all those things.
That's right.
And I think there's love in baseball, which makes it.
It doesn't matter what you do. Do it passionately. Yeah. Figure out something that you love that like makes you want to wake up every day. It doesn't matter if it's baseball, guitars, or whatever.
Yeah.
Having a podcast. Do what you want to do and do it.
Yeah.
And just do it the best you can.
Yeah. And I think that's something to be said about this whole like standing in this room with you. You come in here every day and you help manage this studio, and do you do the building too, or is it really just studio stuff
and artist side of things?
And that's important, because it goes back to having the conversation about Mark coming in here,
mm-hmm.
sitting behind this desk,
mm-hmm.
he knows he's going to come in here and he knows that Tori's going to take care of him,
yeah.
and he knows that all he has to do is show up with his two magical
ears. Everything else take care of.
And everything else behind that is good. And that's that attitude that you have.
Yep.
You have that with the guitars. You have it with the baseball. It's because of the love that you have for those items.
Yeah.
And I think that knowing you over these past few years, I've seen that with all the things you do. And every time I talk to BK about you, she's always like, oh my gosh, Tori's just killing it. He's doing like this and this and this. And you are, but you're playing guitar and keys? Or is it just guitar?
Guitar and just go out, and I'm generally in a situation where I'm TMing and driving and playing guitar and handling tracks and doing this, that, and the other. So it's if something needs done,
mm-hmm.
I'll figure it out.
And you're getting on stage after, like you just said, driving. You probably go take a quick nap somewhere in a dark, quiet room if you can. And then you got to be a TM, which is
it's 24/7,
which is difficult as that. But then you also have to get on stage and smile.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you that the minute you pick up that guitar, you're probably like,
it's like we just drove 14 hours, just dealt with all this, that, and the other of driving, you know, and it's like for 20 minutes of playing. But it's like, that's why you do it.
That's why you
all's
do
cool.
it.
All's cool. I got you my know, 52 telly. All's good. You know?
Is that what you bring with you?
Yeah, I bring that.
That's your girl?
In. Yeah.
That's
the one.
Do you name them?
No, you know, some people do. I kind of name them based on cities where I bought them.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. So, no names.
No name.
Yeah. Or the serial numbers. That's like 2726, 270, 2780. Okay, now we're getting nerdy here.
No. That one doesn't get a name. That's 2767.
Yes. I'm familiar with that one.
But I was, as I walked by it, we'll bring him up here in a second. But as I was walking by it, there was like, it's really cool because as you said, there. Nowadays, it's probably just one general guitar that gets built, and it's scanned out with a barcode, and it's hidden in a bottom place somewhere.
Right.
Those were hand-etched, I'm sure.
Yeah, the serial numbers right on the front of the bridge.
Or something.
Yeah. What's interesting, they stamped 0 through 5,000 all at once, put them in one big bin, and then just pulled out of the bin. So they're not sequential.
Oh, wow.
So you can have one that was built in 51 that has a higher serial number than one that was built in 52.
Wow.
Crazy weird quirks like that.
That is crazy. I think that's what sets those things apart.
Yeah,
from
that's what makes it fun.
Especially when you find something like that, you're like, oh, wait, this is a 50. Whoa, hold on here a second.
Yes.
Now we're talking about something.
Yes, yes.
You're like, and does she have papers?
Bathroom break for me.
Wow. I love how they get strung in the back, too. I totally forgot about that.
Right. And that's a... that's part of the reason why they sound part of like the resonance of it
mm-hmm.
is the fact that you literally the vibration is going through the body.
Yeah.
What's really interesting, this one isn't too bad. The early ones, these are all hand drilled. So they're crooked. Like that one that's sitting over there, the two of them are like side by side and there's a huge gap. It's always hilarious, like looking on the back of them and seeing like, that must have been a Friday, yeah. You know, like at 4 o'clock. Send her through.
time to go. I gotta get to my favorite watering hole. Well, all right. So we took a quick little break so you could grab this guitar mm-hmm. And this is the one that Mick gave you.
Yeah, Mick gave me this.
And you probably just heard us talking about some of the holes on the back. It's where the strings go through.
Yeah, right here. String through. These holes are from Danny Gatton throwing knives into the back of this guitar.
What?
this guitar started as an Esquire, which was a single pickup
mm-hmm.
Telecaster. Meaning no neck pickup, just mm-hmm. was like this. And Mick bought this guitar back, I think in like 76, 77, 78, somewhere around there. And it initially started as blonde,
mm-hmm.
but at this point it had already been stripped. And it was this dark brown. They were playing some show and some guy came up and was like, hey, I've got a used guitar like in my trunk, you know. Popped open the trunk and I was like, $200, $250, you know. At that point, Mick like knew, you know, like it's an old Telecaster, so there's like some value and mm-hmm. he was interested in it.
There's a high chance that there's some stuff in there.
But at the same time, it was like these weren't super, super collectible per se back in the 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. Like the value hadn't really caught up. So,
yeah.
So he bought it and gave it to Danny to go and modify it. So Danny scored this pickup from Seymour Duncan like in 78 from Seymour himself, went and got it, made this pick guard for it, and this neck came off another 1952 Telecaster okay. neck. When I was parting out those guitars uh-huh. I was telling you about, the original neck for this guitar was so worn this way, when you press on the high you just fell off, like there's no wood left there. It was just like so.
Whoa.
And Danny refinished that neck, refretted it, and put a Broadcaster logo. And that neck hangs on my wall in my bedroom. I still have it.
That's cool.
But this one is a TG Taddeo Gomez, as we were talking about, uh-huh. 1052. So it's an October 52 neck that came off a different 52 Tele. So Danny did a bunch of work for it on the guitar, and then right here carved his name into it, Danny Gatton, August 9th, 1978, and gave it back to Mick. And Mick gets it and was like,
yo, you just carved your name in my guitar.
And not only like in a, but like right on the front,
goes,
you know?
Yeah, that's yeah. what I do.
Yeah. So it became like their spare kind of road guitar, joke guitar, where like, I mean, Mick would have it and then Evan would have it when he was out with Danny. And it just kind of got passed around and became more of a thing where if they were playing with Jello Biafra, the Dead Kennedys, or Bill Kirchner, or what, they would just all carve their name into it. And because of it, I mean, it's hard to see in these lights, but there's everybody from Carl Perkins to Neil Young, Bernard Shakey, Jerry Lee Lewis,
Neil Young,
Joey Ramone, cool. Johnny Ramone, Bonnie Raitt, all of NRBQ, Molly Hatchet, weird, like, you know, DC, Virginia type of bands. And
Here you are holding this iconic
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, you know, and when I turned 21, he gave it to me, and I carved my name, let's see here. I guess I got it in 2013.
Yeah, you don't want to carve over anyone important.
No. No. I also, it's hard to see here, but I put my full name right, Tory James Harding.
That's amazing, dude.
And it took me, like, you know, fine tooth. And
well, yeah.
I remember I had
you don't
want to
do that fast.
No, it took some time with it, yeah. And I had to get this appraised for insurance purposes, and I took it to Carter Vintage Guitar.
And they cried.
And Walter, when he gave me the guitar back, he like hands and he hand it to me, and he kind of like points down at my name and just kind of like shakes his head like in disappointment.
He's like, I could have given you an extra $100 until I saw your name in it.
And I was like, dude, what? It's my guitar. You
it
know?
Is
like,
yours now. It, that, but that is exactly the point, is that if you're playing this, you're just as, I mean, you're just as cool as any of the other people that played this.
Well, someday, I mean, if I can keep things going and whatnot, you know, it, I, if I play this around enough, you know, I've been lucky enough to play this on Grand Ole Opry.
Have you really?
Yeah. You know,
that's
like,
amazing.
I could, nobody will never know my name, but just the fact that this guitar was on there and I was the one that helped to get that guitar on the stage, like, it's pretty cool, you
know? That is really cool. It's not just
Robert
pretty cool.
Plant, whoa. Warren Haynes. I've gotten a bunch on here since then. Derek Trucks, Warren Haynes, the Allman Brothers guys. Zach Wilde is somewhere like right here, which is so hilarious to me. But
one,
heavy metal Gibson
heavy metal,
guy,
yeah.
And he was holding this, and it like looked like a little toy as
he's
like
a big man
carving it.
That is too. I mean, but that I have to say, I've seen a lot of cool stuff in history, and that's up there with a lot of.
It should like probably be in the Smithsonian or something. You know what I mean? Like
one day you should put it in there. Actually, you know what? I mean. For you to hold on to it and cherish it, the nice part of the one thing about stuff like that is you still play it.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to be said about something like that. It's like, yeah, maybe like the Mona Lisa you don't take out and put it in your pocket, fold it up and put it in your pocket and walk around with it. That
if
belongs.
I get a ding on this, it's not a big deal.
Gives you it know? More character.
Yeah. It's already pretty.
Well, and you know what the best part about it is that it gets to continue living on with all those people who. There is one of the, are both the Ramones gone? No,
yeah,
just,
I don't know, Johnny or Joey. One of them.
I think it's Joey, the one that went. But I mean, but think about that his name gets to travel still around the world with this guitar, and you get to play it nightly, which would probably just he'd probably rolling around in a grave somewhere, happy as all can be.
And I truly do think, you know, like I said, this will outlive me, and this one was given to me, so. I have this inherent sense of like obligation that someday I'm going to have to give this. I will give this away to somebody at some point, you know, and that's cool too when you think about it because it kind of is like it has this added pressure because you got to make sure that whoever you give it to like really knows.
Yeah, and you know what? It'll come to you too. It won't be someone you choose. They'll choose you.
That's what I'm thinking. And Mick said the same thing. He was like, I used to stress out about this thing sitting in my closet forever. And then it was like out of one night, like all of a sudden it just made sense, you know?
Yeah. You'll meet a kid that wants to like learn how to like recap old amps one day.
Yeah, totally.
And you'll be like,
yeah, I have a 52 Tele in the closet.
And you'll be like, what? And you'll be like, whoa, you're into guitars? And that's the way I think some of the greatest things in history have ever happened is that it's not because you went out looking for it. It's because you just happened to be in the right place.
Yeah, you know, they found you.
God put you in that, you know, like he aligned all the stars and he said, today you are not going to go, you're not going to make that left turn. You're going to go right and you're going to meet this guy out of, you know, left field. He's going
to
like
I was
the
meant to be
too.
The character. Exactly.
You're going to have a checklist. You're like, all right, do you like the Yankees?
Check. Yep. Yeah. Right, right. Fender, Leo,
do you know who Leo
Forrest.
And Forrest are? Not my kids either. Do you know?
But yeah, it's the beauty of it and the magic of it. And it's the thing that, you know, at least keeps me going every day.
Well, I'm personally, and I think that any person listening to this is thank you for sharing such a magical piece of your life with it, because I don't know if we could go on. I mean, we could go on for another 4 hours. I think we're going to have a number two episode. But I think we end on this because to me, looking at this guitar, I'm, for one, very grateful that you took the time to be on the show. But to share this with us is absolutely incredible.
Well, I truly appreciate that. And when you asked me, I was like, oh, shoot, nobody's ever asked me to be on a podcast before. And I was like, this is going to be really cool. And I thought back, one of the first times we ever hung out, and you mentioned this, we go back, but was at that Lizzo concert. Yeah.
And I didn't want to go.
You didn't want, that's right. And I remember sitting in the Ryman with you, and like, we were probably the only two guys in the room.
Potentially, there was like one other guy on the other side, and he looked about as happy as I did. Until I got about 13 vodkas in me. And then I started dancing with you and BK.
But we had this moment where it was like, I know, you know. Yeah. So there was this kind of ease
at the same time, that kind of washed over me. I was like, it's going to be fine. Because we're just going to go and we're just going to freaking talk about the things that we want to talk about. Yeah. And like I said, I just really appreciate it and would love to do a part two.
Yeah,
and,
I think we should definitely do a part two. And I mean, because I keep thinking about it. I'm like, well, before any of my equipment runs out of its time limit, I don't want to miss anything. But at the same time, I'm just so stoked that, you know, like, because to me, punk rock was always a giant thing to me. Like, even though I might not be able to name every player in the business and all that stuff, I love punk. And to sit here and look at this and know that there's that traveled around with a few of those guys and got to play. And
truly,
I mean, the Dead Kennedys.
Truly.
My uncle might have a tear. If you had the Clash on there, that'd be like the ultimate.
They're not. Jello was a huge fan of Evan Johns and the H-Bombs. So he would come as a kid and sit in the front row and like geek out to their shows.
That's amazing.
And he would review like in some of the early magazines, he would review their records and whatnot. So he,
all right.
I've never linked up with him, but I've always wanted to, you know, him to see that.
Well, what we'll do is I'll definitely make a little clip of this guitar in your arms, and what we'll do is we'll just tag
it. Yeah,
we'll just tag a whole bunch of punk rock people, and we'll just tag it. I'll ask you for the list. I'll shoot you a text.
We'll tag them all.
Today is the day that I need a list of guys on this guitar that might have an Instagram.
That might have an Instagram.
Because that's the other
I don't even have an Instagram.
Well, now we're going to have to change that.
Now we're going to have to change
it. I think that what you do let's just say this. What you're doing for music is bigger than I think you see it or that you might realize it, because what you're doing is you're helping generations behind you. You're helping even generations in front of you. Like you informed me today and there was some stuff I never knew. And I think that that's the beauty behind it. So whatever you're doing,
thanks,
don't give up. Just keep that
thanks,
going
man.
On. And I just have to say cheers. Let's bottom these up if you can reach that over there. Yeah, be careful. Cheers. Thank you so much, everyone. I'm blown away right now. Thank you so much for this
thanks,
awesome
Phil.
Day today. Thank you for this room. Yeah, cheers,
yeah,
man.
Cheers, Starstruck.
Yeah, cheers to Starstruck. Bottoms up, my friend. I actually drank a lot.